Hi, I'm Wayne Jones. Welcome to Editing Writing. This is episode 28, The Five Possible Fates of Any Word in the English Language. So earlier this week, I was talking to a friend of mine about dictionaries, and actually more specifically, we were talking about a single dictionary, the Oxford English Dictionary, the big one, as they say, or as I say anyway. And it was probably one of those senior moments where I may have talked to him before about this, and he was just indulging me. And I certainly know that on this podcast and other episodes, I mentioned the dictionary. It's the reason I've mentioned it before, and I'm actually going to talk a little bit more about it in this episode. But in other episodes, it's one of the premier works of scholarship of any kind in any language. That's why it's not when someone just says, oh, I'm looking something up in a dictionary. This is not just any other dictionary. This is the prime dictionary in English. This is what they call an historical dictionary, which means that, you'll often see the word current on many dictionaries that you see either electronically or on bookshelves somewhere. This is a current dictionary in the sense that you can use it to find out what a word currently means, but it's an historical dictionary in the sense that it will trace the history of a word from the first time it appeared in English up to the present day. And typically also, one big difference is that in current dictionaries, usually they list the meanings in order of how common they are, what a word is most used for, down to what it's least used to mean. And that's not how historical dictionaries work. For any entry in a historical dictionary, it's listed historically. So it'll be, this is the first appearance and this is when it was first used, not, whether this meaning exists or not now or exists in the same way. So it's really, there's nothing like it as far as I know, and actually I'm going out a bit on a limb here in saying that, but in any other language to the degree that it's done for English, it basically defines all the words in the English language back beyond the Norman Conquest. Remember 1066? So you're talking about 1,000 years of English. It's just incredible, just the sort of the thought of it. What I was saying to him, the thing that got us talking was that I said that I had a sort of a memory in my head that, which is the best place to keep memories, by the way, that the word set, S-E-T, is the longest definition in the dictionary. And I looked it up later, did a little checking online, and in fact, that's the case. The word, to define the word set, if you look at the dictionary, it has 9 separate huge categories of meaning, usually based on the parts of speech, like, it's a verb, it's a noun, it's an adjective, that sort of thing. It has 9 of those. The entire definition has 60,000 words, which is the length of a normal-sized novel. And the word first came to be used in the English language around 725, not 1725, 725. I just admire so much the research that it would take to make sense of that, to bring all those pieces together, to trace it back that early. One thing I did find, though, in looking around, I found this in Wikipedia. I didn't follow beyond that, but they had the sources for it. Is that they're now working on a, of course, it's a dictionary, so it's being updated all the time, and it's an online dictionary, it's a database, basically, but they're bringing out what they're, they're calling now the OED-3, which is the big one. It first sort of came out in its first edition in the early 20th century, then there was one in the later 20th century, and now the one that they're working on now, where they will update it, incorporate all the updates since then, they call the OED-3, and it's looking like the word run is going to become the longest definition in the dictionary. So that's interesting. Actually, now that I think of it, it sort of suggests kind of activity. Set is staying in place, and run is running right past it as far as the number of words go. So this is a word, the word set, still is a word that has survived, but not all words do survive in English. And some become, you know, what is called obsolete, and they're usually labeled that way in the dictionary. But just to go through the five different kinds, I'll do that, and then I'll have something to say about each of them. So the five fates are basically that a word survives. The word set, for example, has survived since the year 725, still exists in English, and still exists in myriad forms, myriad meanings. Fate number two is that a word survives, but the meaning changes. And a good example of this one, or the example I remember anyway, is the word nice, N-I-C-E, which has also been around for a long time in English. It used to mean ignorant. Its original meaning was ignorant. But it now, of course, means something very different from that, unless you're saying it sarcastically. Oh, he's very nice. So survives, but changes its meaning. The third thing that happens to words in English is that they survive, but they gain new meanings. This happens a lot. And I think a great example here of that is the word gay, which used to mean, used to only mean happy, you know, that sort of thing. And now, of course, means homosexual. And I could easily imagine, I'm not a scholar in this or anything, but I mean, that meaning, that new meaning that it attained is now so prevalent and so fixed in people's minds that you could imagine that eventually the old meanings will be lost and through underuse, if nothing else. You know, it would be hard to, I think when people hear that word now, you immediately think homosexual, you don't think happy. And in fact, teenagers probably titter over it when they see the word gay used in, there's that Christmas carol, right? Don, we now are gay apparel. So that's a whole different gay apparel is a whole different thing now than they envisioned in that Christmas carol. So that's the third thing that happens. A word gains new meanings. It not only stays around, but broadens. The fourth thing that happens is that a word survives, but it becomes rare. And that's how it'll usually be labeled, that the classic label they use in the dictionary, rare. And a good example of that will be a word that I didn't know until I did a little poking around. And I'm going to try to pronounce it correctly. It's spelled A-D-S-C-I-T-I-T-I-U-S. Adscititious. So I'll give you 5 seconds to try to figure out what it means, but it means forming an addition or a supplement. It means something that's not integral. It's an adjective, obviously. So that's rarely used. And I could say that the only way I know about it is because of a book I'm writing about a man who compiled another dictionary in the 18th century. And he included that word in his dictionary. And that word also appears in the Oxford English Dictionary labeled rare. And there are also words, the fifth fate of a word is what you can imagine, is that a word does not survive. And that's what I already mentioned. A word becomes obsolete. That's the lexicographical equivalent of dying, basically. It used to exist. It no longer exists in practical terms. And I found a good example here. And frankly, I'd love to see this word come back, to be raised from the dead and be used again. Bedpresser, very common words and everything. In the dictionary, I mentioned the Samuel Johnson, the man I'm writing the book about, in his dictionary, which was in 1755, he defined it as a heavy, lazy fellow. So in the Oxford English Dictionary, it's just labeled as obsolete, but bedpresser. So there you go. Those are the five fates: surviving, but the meaning changing, surviving and gaining new meanings, surviving but becoming rare, and effectively not surviving. Those are the typical five fates of a word. And I was specifically thinking about this because I was thinking about a couple of words that I've noticed over one fairly recently and one for several years now, where the meaning is changing or there's an additional meaning being added. And the first word is necessarily. I don't know if you've, it's the kind of word where it just sort of just the flits by in what a lot of people say. I listen to a fair number of podcasts, and I hear this word a lot used in this new meaning that I've identified. It used to mean, or it used to be used to mean, you know, something where there's two or more possibilities or things or outcomes or facts or whatever. You know, for example, you could say something like, he can save money on gas, but not necessarily by buying an electric vehicle. For example, he could buy a smaller car. So that's a classic way, if I could say, of using necessarily. It implies that there is this thing you could do. You could save money on gas, but not necessarily by buying an electric vehicle, i.e. that's not the only way you could save money on gas. But now when I've heard it used, I heard today on a podcast, it was an episode of talking about the tech industries, and this is the direct quote that the guy said. It was talking about the idea of small tech companies having difficulty in competing with large tech companies for talent, like Google and the other ones. He was comparing a lot. They were talking a little bit about the brain drain of tech to the U.S., but then this guy said, quote, Canada is not necessarily the poor victim in all of this. We act as the U.S. in some ways. And in that sentence, necessarily, as I read it anyway, doesn't perform any function. It doesn't mean anything there. If I read the sentence without necessarily, quote, Canada is not the poor victim in all of this. We act as the U.S. in some ways. It means the same thing. It means the same thing that he intended. So I'm not sure what's happening to necessarily there. It's like it's turning into a word, or at least one of its other, it's like a fill-in word kind of thing. And there are those kinds of words in English that sort of they add a little bulk to your sentence, but in effect they don't contribute anything meaning wise. The classic and the one I detest in English that is way overused is the term in terms of. You'll see a lot of people using that one, and it basically doesn't mean anything. It's usually used in cases when people, they know they want to say A, and they know they want to say B, and they know there's some kind of connection between them, and they'll stick in terms of to make it sound like a real sentence. But yeah, that's what I think is happening there. Canada is not necessarily the poor victim in all of this. We act as the U.S. in some ways. So I find that interesting. And that's something I've only noticed in the last couple of years. Again, I'm not situating myself as someone who follows this, you know, intensely closely. It may have been going on for much longer than that. And there's the other one that I'd noticed definitely years and years ago. And this one has now officially gone where it used to have a certain meaning, and it just gained another meaning. But I noticed it at first, and I would first think, let's say several years ago, oh no, they're using the wrong word there. And the word I'm talking about is reticent. And it used to mean, well, and still means, as they define it in the big Merriam-Webster dictionary online, quote, inclined to be silent or uncommunicative in speech, reserved. It used to mean that. And then what I found is that you'd hear a lot of people using it to mean reluctant, and reluctant usually means, unwilling. I'm reluctant to drive in a car if someone is driving 250 kilometers an hour, that kind of thing. But you saw it being used for that word. People would use reticent instead. I checked the OED on this, and it turns out that, yes, reticent came into the language in the early 19th century, and it meant the first meaning. It meant about being reserved. But by the late 19th century, when, even though I'm a little old, I'm not quite that old, it did start to take on this new meaning, and meaning reluctant. And now it's well established. In fact, in that dictionary, that other great online dictionary called the Merriam-Webster dictionary, Merriam is very important in it, it gives reluctant as a third meaning, basically just flat out as a kind of a synonym for reticent. So there's where you see sort of a change with a meaning being added, basically. The other thing, just sort of on a, just to take a little side road on this, another thing you'll find in English is that sometimes a word will survive, but its meaning will be still illogical, but everyone knows what you're talking about. And this is a case basically where the meaning has changed. And the three ones that came to me had to do with, communication of some kind. You know, for example, you'll often hear reporters talking about getting the tape of an interview. And of course, they're not using cassette tapes anymore, but that's what they'll use. Or you hear people talking about a film, you know, movies, for example, that, you know, you'll allow film studies is the common term for how you study movies in universities, for example. But many movies, I'm not sure of the proportions, but many movies, of course, never ever make it to film. They're done digitally now, and there's no film involved. And the other one that occurred to me is manuscript. You'll hear people talking about a book manuscript being submitted to the publisher or to the agent or to whoever, to the editor. And, of course, manuscript generally, or at least in its first early meanings, was something that was handwritten. And, no one will accept, I can say that certainly as an editor myself, I'm not going to accept any handwritten manuscripts that are sent to me for editing. And the other thing, this is taking a detour, is that you see the same, I've always found this fascinating, you see the same thing for visual icons in computers usually. And I'm not the first to notice these, but I've always found them fascinating. Like the classic icon that you see in various softwares for saving something is a little graphic of the, some people are probably too young to remember it, but there used to be what was called a 3.5-inch diskette, a little square thing. And that is often now still used to mean save, because you used to save it to the diskette. And of course, the diskettes are not used anymore. I remember it being a big deal when Dell computers dropped the diskette drive from their computer, and it caused the same fuss that Apple caused with their phone a couple of years ago, when they didn't have a headphone jack in there. It was the same sort of thing. People were all upset about it. But it's interesting that the icon survives, but the object itself is never used anywhere anymore. You see a similar sort of thing sometimes for telephone numbers when they're sort of stylizing them online. Say if they don't want to write phone number, they'll put a little... And often, though, it'll be those old-style phones with the two big knobs at the end, and usually black. to mean telephone. And of course, again, I mean, I'm exaggerating. It's not 100%, but that's not what a telephone looks like anymore. A telephone looks like the thing that you have in your pocket or in your purse or wherever. Another classic thing that's related to this is that you see often when writers have websites, they will have a photo of a manual typewriter there somewhere. And again, you know, there's very few probably writers who use manual typewriters anymore. At some point, you have to get that text, that manuscript, into electronic form and submit it to wherever its next step is. So that's interesting. But it's fascinating that those survive like that. I'm not sure. I have seen, I have to say, with the telephone one, you do see sometimes a little graphic that looks like the sort of the screen and the little bit around what the front of a cell phone would look like. But you certainly do see the old-style telephone one as well. It's quite fascinating. So just to sum up about the Oxford English Dictionary, I was looking at its website as well, and its tagline is 600,000 words, 3.5 million quotations, over 1,000 years of English. And that's quite an accomplishment. And by the way, if you're not familiar again with historical dictionaries, the mention of the quotations there is a very, very important thing, because that's how you determine not only meanings and changes in meanings, but you know, the classic thing, one of the classic things that they try to do in the OED is to find the first time when something appeared in print. And it may be beyond print now, like the first time a word started being used, like 725 for the word set. So the quotations are quotations from, it's basically like, you know, showing your footnotes, basically. That's why the quotations are very, very important, essential, basically, in an historical dictionary. So I always think of the OED as like a live organism. It always feels that way to me. It doesn't feel like a dull database that I'm consulting. And in a sense, it is live. I mean, it is a manifestation of human culture and human communication. So it's this thing that's tracking a human activity. So in that sense, it is alive. That would be maybe a good sci-fi for nerds, where the OED actually comes alive. But the main thing too, because it is human, or it is reflecting or recording or documenting something that humans do, the main thing to remember about it is that everything changes.